You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2023 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, as the US sanctions a private Chinese company for providing help to the Russian Wagner Group, we'll query the extent of Beijing's involvement. Then to Ukraine to look at how the supply of Western tanks might change Russian tactics. Plus,
we will work more closely with them, with South Korea, with Japan, with Australia and New Zealand. But a membership is not the issue. Closer partnership is what we are going to do.
NATO's Secretary General is midway through a trip to South Korea and Japan. Just what is the military alliance hoping to achieve in drawing closer to the Indo-Pacific? We'll peel off the layers of a story about an onion shortage in the Philippines and...
Never mind SpaceX, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, the space race has a new entrant. I'm Guy Delorme, and I'll be telling you all about minuscule Montenegro's effort to reach for the stars.
Thank you, Guy. With a flick through the front pages and all the latest transport news, that's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said that Ankara could accept Finland into NATO without its Nordic neighbour, Sweden. Peru's President Dina Boluarte has appealed again for Congress to hold early elections as a way to end weeks of deadly protests. And New Zealand is bracing for more heavy rains this week with more severe weather alerts. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, China says it's a neutral party with regard to the Ukraine war. However, it is a close ally of Russia. And now a Chinese tech firm has been sanctioned by the US government for providing satellite images to the Russian mercenary Wagner Group. Well, I'm joined by Ian Williams, a journalist and author of Fire of the Dragon, China's New Cold War, and Isabel Hilton, international journalist and visiting professor at King's College London's Lauer Institute. Isabel, let's unpack this. Firstly, is Spacity China a private entity or is it linked to Xi Jinping's government?
I don't think any company in this business in China survives without links to the Chinese government. There is very much a blending of private and public in China. And this is a company that was, it's a relatively small company, but it's a company that hopes to get in the business of launching satellites worldwide. It's working closely with other Chinese entities like a couple of universities and the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the China Aerospace Science and Industry Corporation, China Electronics Tech Group Corporation, and so on. Now, these are all state enterprises. You can't really get away from the state in such a sensitive area in China.
Mm. And Ian, what information is the company providing? How does it help the 50,000 or so Wagner operatives currently fighting in Ukraine?
Well, this is high-resolution satellite imagery, and the accusation is that the company has been providing this to a Russian-based tech firm, which in turn has been passing it on to the Wagner Group. Now, the fear is that this information, these images, have been used to enable the Wagner Group to establish Ukrainian positions and to target those positions. So it's a very overt breaking of sanctions, which of course apply to foreign companies which enable the Russian war machine. So this is a very serious accusation. And the use of these of this satellite imagery potentially has been very valuable to the Wagner Group, which, as we've seen, has been making, albeit small, advances in Ukraine.
Mm. Isabel, how common is that? How common might it be for Chinese firms to provide services to Russia and to other countries which are under sanctions?
Well, China has a very close relationship with Russia, as we know, confirmed at the highest level last February with a declaration of limitless friendship. Now, that's been followed up. The space cooperation was pre-existing. China's building a space platform, for example, and Russia is involved, although mention of Russia has faded slightly, but Russia is definitely still involved in that platform. So, you know, a close working relationship is pretty common stuff. It's also worth noting that China made exactly the same accusation against a US firm in April of 2022, when the People's Liberation Army Daily, which is the army's official newspaper, ran a commentary complaining that US companies like Maxar and Black Sky were providing satellite imagery of Russian troop movements to Ukraine. And this, ironically enough, the People's Liberation Army Daily complained was an example of the United States civil-military fusion. Now, again, that's an accusation that the United States levels regularly against China, mm-hmm. to say that private companies are really acting in a security capacity. So we've got both superpowers probably practicing much the same thing and accusing each other of being the only criminal. But certainly, if this is going on, it really wouldn't surprise me that Russia continues to have access to Chinese technology.
And Ian, is China treading a fine line here, doing business with Russia, but not quite enough to trigger sanctions?
It is. And if we look at the latest trade figures that have come out of Beijing, bilateral trade with China is up something like about a third last year over the previous year. And this is in spite of the restrictions and the difficulties of doing trade during the pandemic. Now, if you look at the makeup of that trade, it's overwhelmingly hydrocarbons. There's been a big boost in Russian exports to China of gas, of oil, but also of consumer electronics, appliances, sort of stuff which potentially is dual use, but perhaps falls just the other side of a difficult line for China. So I think that they've been quite pragmatic in terms of their trade and their assistance for Russia, certainly increasing trade, certainly helping in terms of Russia's avoidance of the dollar economy, because a lot of this trade is in yuan or rubles, but treading a fine line in not wanting to attract secondary sanctions from the United States or the EU. But certainly trade, help, assistance is up, and technology sales are up quite significantly.
Mm. I mean, technology is very important in this, isn't it, Isabel? That there's a rumbling US-China tech war. How relevant is that to this?
I think it's an important part of the background. And as we know, under Donald Trump, the sanctions were imposed against China for actually not for violating sanctions, but just out of concern that the US has that China might achieve a kind of technological dominance in AI, in space technology, and in those areas of technology that are going to determine the future in a number of ways, including in the military realm. And we've seen since then an increasing concern in the Biden administration. In fact, the sanctions have been ramped up. Trying explicitly, and US officials have acknowledged this, to slow down China's technological development in these vital areas. And they're particularly concerned, as far as space is concerned, about China's ambitions to be the provider of space technologies to middle-income countries, which will give China a global network of space capacity. And that becomes a problem for US military operations anywhere in the world. So, you know, there's a concern about the bigger picture, of which this is an absolutely key example.
Mm. And Ian, do you think that these particular new sanctions are related to the US wanting to steal a march on Chinese tech?
I don't think so. I mean, that is the broader picture. Clearly, there is a technological Cold War going on here, and it's being waged by both sides. I mean, let's not forget that decoupling arguably began in China. It's been a policy of Xi Jinping for many years to become self-sufficient in technology. But I think that the particular sales of technology to Russia are a separate area of concern. And it's also notable that in this partnership, this friendship between Russia and China, we are seeing China really emerge as the senior partner, as the far stronger of the two countries. This has been a trend now for some time, but technologically, China is considerably more advanced than Russia, and Russia is becoming increasingly dependent upon that tech. But I see it as concerning, but a separate factor to the bigger trade war that's being, or technological trade war that's being waged between the US and China.
Mm. And finally, Isabel, as South Korea and Japan draw closer to NATO, how might China respond to that?
Well, curiously, in contrast to their relative silence on the sanctions against this particular company, China is pretty vocal about Japan and South Korea, and any suggestion that their security posture could be raised. Of course, it's China's actions that is raising or causing Japan and South Korea to become more concerned, and to, you know, at least in Japan, there is a fairly active discussion about whether Japan should go nuclear and what posture Japan's traditional, you know, pacifist armed forces should adopt in future. China will accuse those countries and the United States of forming anti-China alliances. China proclaims itself against military alliances, but it's becoming very difficult, I think, for China to maintain the image of just another developing country with no global ambitions. It's clearly in sharp contrast to its posture. But we'll see increasing tensions in the region as these battle lines continue to be drawn.
Isabel, thank you very much indeed. That was Isabel Hilton and Ian Williams there. This is The Globalist. It's 12 minutes past 10 in Moscow, that's 7:12 here in London. Following the announcement that Western powers will send tanks to Ukraine, will this force a change in direction from Russia? Well, I'm joined by Jenny Mathers, Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Aberystwyth University, to discuss this. Jenny, good morning to you. Will the tanks heading to Ukraine be enough to significantly impact Kyiv's efficiency on the battlefield?
Well, I think this is the question that everyone is asking. I mean, obviously, the provision of these tanks, which are much more modern, much better at accuracy in terms of firing, much better at protecting the crew who are in the tanks, they will make a definite difference, and they will give the Ukrainians a technical advantage that they haven't had, and they'll also give them a very strong morale boost, both of which are very important. Now, of course, it requires more than just the addition of new tanks to turn the tide. And I think this is where we're going to see how effectively the additional training and strategizing and the intelligence that the Ukrainians have had from the Western side, you know, from the beginning, how all of this comes together now that the sort of equipment and technology is more keeping pace, shall we say, with what the Ukrainians have been saying that they've been needing from the beginning.
Mm. And I wonder how this will play out on the ground. Will Russia rethink tactics?
Well, I think we've been seeing throughout is Russia readjusting its tactics almost from the beginning, you know, when it was clear from the early days of the February 2022 invasion that they could not take control of the capital, they could not take control of the country, they couldn't replace the government. They had to withdraw, regroup, shift their attention more to the east and also to the south of Ukraine, and that's where it's been. And then similarly, once they started being pushed back in the summer by the Ukrainians, they really shifted to a much greater emphasis on attacking civilian targets throughout Ukraine. And then after the Crimean Bridge was was struck in October. Then there's been another shift, which is really to attacking not only civilian infrastructure, but especially energy infrastructure, and really trying to punish the Ukrainians and make them suffer over the winter.
And the commitment by the US and Europe to send heavy weaponry is clearly evidence of their growing direct involvement. Now, that's a move that Russia has long warned would mean consequences for the West. Do you think we can expect retaliatory action?
Well, I think it depends on what we all understand by direct involvement. You know, Western troops are not fighting on the ground in Ukraine. You know, no Western government is sending its own forces to fight there. So what Western governments are providing is weapons, they're providing money, they're providing equipment and ammunition, and they're providing a lot of training as well as diplomatic support. In terms of Russian retaliation, well, I think we've, again, I think we've seen that right from the beginning in terms of Russia's efforts to use energy as a weapon, Russia's efforts to try and find ways of getting at Western governments, trying to make them suffer, make their populations suffer through the winter. So I think, you know, we will certainly see Putin reaching for any levers that he thinks he has. But I think an outright attack on a NATO member state would be an exceptionally risky and foolish thing for Russia to do. And I would be very, very surprised indeed to see them do that.
And I wonder, Jenny, if the balance of power in the West has shifted with Eastern Europe and the Baltics leading the agenda, and how that might affect future developments.
Well, I think what we've seen over the past nearly year is a gradual move towards, as you say, towards this, the position that, that countries like the Baltic states have taken really from the outset, which is the need to support Ukraine much more sort of consistently and on a wider ranging basis. So the countries further to the west, shall we say, have been playing catch up very much along those lines. But as the Ukrainians have demonstrated that they can use these weapons and equipment and training and intelligence so effectively that they can make a difference, that they have, you know, a very good chance of succeeding at pushing Russia out of their territory, I think that has also encouraged countries like the US, Britain, Germany also to think, well, all right, this is something that we can do and something that we should do. And it will have an actual effect. So yes, there has been a step-by-step development towards the position that the Baltics have taken really from the outset.
And there are reports that Russia's suffered major losses in Donetsk. Do you have any details on that?
Well, not very specific details, because I think the numbers are very much, you know, in dispute, and there are lots of numbers that are flying around. But I think what's clear is that Russia has expended an awful lot of effort in trying to take really quite small towns and cities in the Donetsk area region, such as Bakhmut and Soledar. And even if they are successful in taking control, it's possible that they won't keep control, because the Ukrainians are quite determined to take these territories back. But also it's been, you know, at a very heavy cost. And these are areas also where the Wagner Group, a private military company, has been very active. They've been particularly brutal. They've brought in a lot of prisoners from Russian prisons with promises of, you know, pardons and so on if they survive the war, and really just use them as cannon fodder, been very, very ruthless in putting them forward and sacrificing them. So it's been a very brutal, particularly brutal phase of the war. And I think, you know, Russia is paying a very high price for any very limited gains that they've made.
Mm. And I wonder if you could bring us up to speed on any other developments in Ukraine over the weekend. It hasn't been a quiet time for them.
No, indeed. And there's been more attacks from Russia over the weekend, particularly in Kherson and Kharkiv, which are, you know, two cities where the Russians were pushed back and where the Ukrainians now control the territory or most of the territory. And the Russians are still, continuing to attack those cities and those areas. So it's very clear that Russia hasn't given up. It wants to continue to make life difficult for the Ukrainians in any way that it can. And it wants to demonstrate that it's determined to succeed in this war.
Jenny, thank you very much indeed. That's Jenny Mathers there. Now, still to come on the programme, Monocle's man in the Balkans tell us of Montenegro's plans to go to space.
Never mind SpaceX, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, the space race has a new entrant. I'm Guy Delaunay, and I'll be telling you all about minuscule Montenegro's effort to reach for the stars.
This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Though neither South Korea nor Japan are members of NATO, the Secretary General of the military alliance, Jens Stoltenberg, is midway through a trip to Seoul and Tokyo, hoping to strengthen ties with the US allies in the face of the war in Ukraine and rising competition with China. For a readout on the outcome of those meetings, I'm joined by Stephen Borowick, a journalist and contributing writer for Nikkei Asia in Seoul, and Tomohiko Taniguchi, who is a former special advisor to the cabinet of Shinzo Abe. Steve, what were the major takeaways from Stoltenberg's meetings in Seoul?
There seem to be two kind of major developments. The first is that Stoltenberg made a pretty clear call on the Republic of Korea to step up their direct military support for Ukraine, which is attempting to ward off Russian aggression and is kind of poking at Korea's heretofore policy to not directly supply military-grade weapons and kind of provide other forms of non-military support. Stoltenberg, in his comments today, he called on the government of Korea, and he mentioned that there have been other countries that started the early stages of this conflict with such a policy, but have since changed their minds, and he's calling on Korea to make a kind of forceful display of support for the values that NATO espouses. And the other one that the local media is paying a fair bit of attention to is Stoltenberg has underscored the importance of what they call extended deterrence. And South Korea is a close ally of the U.S. And the principle of extended deterrence is that U.S. allies such as South Korea and Japan need not have their own nuclear weapons, because the nuclear weapons that the United States possesses, they would, if necessary, use those to defend their allies. And so these two countries fall under what they call a nuclear umbrella. And this appears to be an allusion to recent comments by South Korean President Moon Suk-yeol, alluding to the possibility of this, of Korea developing their own nuclear weapons in response to the threat posed by North Korea. So as far as I can tell, those are the two main issues that are under the discussion now.
So we know that South Korea recently signed an agreement with Poland to provide heavy tanks and self-propelled artillery and a fighter trainer aircraft that in turn frees up Warsaw to release its own equipment to Ukraine. How has Seoul's involvement in the war in Ukraine gone down at home?
Well, it's not been really front page news in that Korea, the public discussion here tends to be much more focused on matters that are closer to home. This year, the past year or so has been a time of quite a lot of military activity by North Korea, and the domestic conversation has also noticed some recent moves by Japan to increase its own military capabilities. Here, I think the government is dealing with a kind of dual priorities, where the UN administration wants to bolster an image of itself as very committed to these what they call universal values of freedom and democracy and a market economy. And as we all know, the war in Ukraine is a really kind of a crystallization of kind of the free world versus an aggressive and autocratic country in Russia. And I think South Korea wants to be a vocal proponent of the NATO-led efforts and be on the side of the U.S. and on the side of other free democracies. But at the same time, Russia is something of a economic partner for Korea, and there's a number of South Korean companies that have important interests in Russia. And so I think the government does want to be supportive, but they are dealing with a kind of slate, a myriad of priorities.
Mm. Tomohiko, let's come to you now. Stoltenberg is in Japan. Do we know yet what's come out of talks there?
Well, it's too early to say anything substantial at the moment, I'm afraid, Georgina. But I think the talk between the Secretary General and Japanese Prime Minister Kishida will focus slightly more on the Indo-Pacific aspect, given the fact that NATO has issued its own strategic concept focusing on the Indo-Pacific, and Japan has just issued three important defense-related documents, again, focusing on the Indo-Pacific. So it's going to be as if European land-based major authoritarian regimes must be sandwiched, if you like, between NATO and the Indo-Pacific-based alliance network, like ROK, Japan, Australia, certainly with the United States. And I think that's the sort of political signal that the Secretary General and the Japanese Prime Minister will be willing to present to the rest of the world.
So we know that Japan's presently constrained by self-imposed rules that means it can't send offensive weapons to any country involved in a conflict. Do you think that this rule could be lifted in the future, and is that perhaps what Stoltenberg is after?
I think the Secretary General should voice his interest in that direction, because Japan has done nothing of that sort. And the opposition within the Japanese people against that is still substantial. But I think as a major nation, Japan is responsible of doing its own fair share in times of crisis like this. And I think Secretary General should push the Japanese government to do more.
Steve, Yoon and Kishida became the first leaders from their countries to attend a NATO summit. They joined alliance leaders as observers last year. And following that, South Korea opened its first diplomatic mission to NATO. Do you think this is laying the path for the North Atlantic Treaty to expand to the Indo-Pacific? I mean, is membership on the agenda?
Right.
As far as I know, we might be going a little bit too far down the road to speculate about that. I think in the more short term, this Yoon's appearance on this stage, I think, is just in line with his and the government's overall efforts to carve out a larger and more influential security posture for South Korea, and to distinguish this country as one that is leading and participating on these matters. I also wonder, you know, earlier you mentioned South Korean defense exports to Poland. I mean, I wonder how much this has to do with bolstering the South Korean defense industry, which has undergone some pretty impressive growth in recent years. I do imagine that when Yoon and other South Korean officials travel on these kinds of events overseas, they are probably being accompanied by people from the major arms manufacturers, and there's a kind of commercial as well as a diplomatic element to this.
Yeah. Tomohiko, obviously this visit is all to do with countering aggression from North Korea and from China. I wonder how those two countries are likely to react to this growing closeness with NATO.
For North Korea, the central concern and interest for that country has always been and will continue to be the United States. But China, as a global power, should be very much keenly watching the development that's going on between the ROK and NATO and between Japan and NATO. And it's been quite some time, actually, since NATO has chosen to reach out to Australia, Japan, and the ROK, naming these three nations partner nations. And NATO has just launched another framework within which countries such as Belgium, Australia, France, and Japan gather knowledge and know-how to contribute to the safety of the globe. And so NATO is gaining its global posture. And to that end, South Korea, Japan, and Australia are ideal partners. And both of these developments could send and are sending, I think, a powerful signal to Beijing. Beijing is keenly watching those developments.
Tomohiko, thank you. Tomohiko Taniguchi there and Steve Borowick. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said that Ankara could accept Finland into NATO without its Nordic neighbour Sweden. Erdogan was speaking just days after Ankara suspended NATO accession talks with the two countries after a protest in Stockholm in which a far-right politician burned a copy of the Quran. Every member of the 30-nation NATO alliance needs to approve Finland and Sweden's membership, and Turkey and Hungary are the only remaining countries that haven't done so yet. Peru's president, Dina Boluarte, has appealed again for Congress to hold early elections as a way to end weeks of deadly protests. The South American country has been in a political crisis since the beginning of December, when former president Pedro Castillo was arrested after attempting to dissolve Congress and rule by decree. At least 48 people have died in clashes so far. And New Zealand is bracing for more heavy rains this week with more severe weather alerts. At least four people have died in flash floods and landslides that hit Auckland in the past 3 days amid record downpours. Flights to and from Auckland Airport are still experiencing delays and cancellations. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Last month, inflation in the Philippines reached a 14-year high, and one standout example of this is the price of onions. A kilo now costs more than the daily minimum wage in Manila. Dr. Leonardo Lanzona is a professor of economics at the Ateneo de Manila University in the Philippines and really knows his onions. Leonardo, many thanks for joining us. Let's begin with the bigger picture. Why is inflation so high?
Well, inflation actually in the Philippines was sort of imported from abroad. You have all of these currency depreciation. When the dollar became, you know, very strong, it caused a weakness in the Philippine peso. Therefore, we needed more dollars to actually spend for our imports. And the Philippines has been very dependent on the imports, particularly gasoline and everything. So with the depreciation of the peso, the country experienced a very high inflation. It's around 8.2% during this period.
And why are onions in particular so expensive?
Actually, the price of onions went even higher than the inflation. So it's not really the inflation that is causing the surge in the onion prices. The usual explanation is that there was a shortage in supply. However, more recent data, in fact, showed that in the third quarter of 2022, there was even an increase in onion production. And in fact, overall in the Philippines, agricultural production went up. Not much, but there was still an increase in agricultural production. So it really has nothing to do with the supply shortage, nor the inflation. It has something to do, I think, mainly with the distribution of the commodity. The data that we have here show that, you know, the farm gate prices, the prices that the farmers receive, it actually has fallen to maybe around 20 pesos per kilo, way, way below what they were getting before. And yet the prices that are sold in the market went up to around 700 per kilo, 600 per kilo in the early part of January. So there seems to be some kind of market manipulation on the part of the big merchants who are selling these commodities, the onions.
How important are onions in the national cuisine? I mean, is there a huge demand for them?
Yeah, there is. Actually, it's a staple vegetable in the Philippines, most of our the usual food that we eat would require a lot of onions.
I understand there've even been cases of onion smuggling. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's true. Actually, the Department of Agriculture, they found a lot of storage facilities that had a lot of onions, and they found out that they came from abroad. So in fact, it would seem that, you know, the usual case is that if they're smuggling, the price of the product that's being smuggled should go down. But in this particular case, they're keeping the smuggled products maybe in anticipation of even higher prices coming in. So the fact that you have not many suppliers existing right now caused this artificial shortage in the market, and therefore it created a lot of opportunities for hoarders, for smugglers, you know, and a lot of these, you know, large syndicates in a way controlling the prices of onions.
So I understand it's now legal to import onions. How is that impacting on the local growers?
Well, right now the prices have more or less gone down to maybe about half of what we experienced last January. The thing though is that if we have all of this importation, the demand for the locally produced onions would fall, and therefore farmers would again experience lower prices because of the importation that is coming in. So in the end, it's good for the consumers, but definitely it's going to be very bad for the farmers.
So what's the solution here? How do you get prices down?
I think the problem is that during the COVID-19 pandemic, we have a lot of these small retailers that were closed down because of the lack of customers. We had the longest lockdown in Southeast Asia. And as a result of that, the small retailers, the small merchants, they all were sort of eliminated by the COVID pandemic. And so what happened was that only the large merchants that, you know, had all of their resources that were able to survive and weather this crisis. So it would seem to me that the solution is to help the small merchants who were adversely affected by the pandemic, as well as the farmers, to directly transact with the customers themselves. So it's really a problem of distribution. I mean, there have been reports that farmers have been dumping their products because apparently the prices that they are being offered to are way, way below their cost. So they would rather just throw away their products. So if we are able to empower the small merchants, the farmers themselves, to have access to the markets, then that would solve the problem. Because it's not a supply problem, it's a distribution problem.
And finally, Leonardo, I've seen a wonderful picture of a bride with a bouquet of onions. How is the onion-loving population dealing with it?
Well, a lot of people are sort of, you know, making lots of jokes about it. That's how we Filipinos usually deal with our problems. We laugh about it, but, you know, the problem never gets solved. And then we encounter it again the following year. Previously, we were sort of laughing about the dictatorship, and now, you know, the son of the dictator has come back. No, it's something that we have to solve. No? Something that we cannot just laugh about. And even though, I guess, to some extent, it has the importation that has occurred has sort of reduced the prices. The problem remains. No? The distribution problem remains. I don't think we can sustain all of this importation in the long run.
Leonardo, many thanks. That's Dr. Leonardo Lanzerna there with No Tears for Onions. You're listening to The Globalist. It's 10:38 in Ankara, 8:38 in Zurich, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me on the line is Ruth Michelson, who's a journalist based in Istanbul. Hello to you, Ruth. Let's start with the Middle East, because, of course, we've seen awful violence between Israel and Palestine. Do you want to tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Egypt for a three-day visit to the Middle East. Unfortunately, exactly as you say, in the midst of what various newspapers are describing as a rise in violence, a spasm in violence in Israel and the occupied West Bank, There were 10 people killed in an Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on Thursday. There have been reprisal attacks. There was a Palestinian gunman who killed 7 people outside a synagogue in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The Guardian also has coverage from the scene after the attack, mentioning that the new Israeli prime minister, or new again Israeli prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is taking a series of actions, including pursuing the families of Palestinian attackers, doing what he said he would do this week to strengthen settlements, which is a move that is considered illegal under international law, and loosening restrictions on carrying guns for the wider Israeli population. So this coverage in The Guardian mentioning that Blinken is landing in the middle of this in an effort to try and de-escalate tensions.
Mm. Now, the Washington Post also has a big story about Israeli settler attacks.
Absolutely. So the coverage, unfortunately, there has been so much violence since between Thursday and now that each outlet has unfortunately had plenty of material to go into quite a lot of depth about the nature of the attacks. So the Washington Post quotes the Palestinian news agency Wafa talking about 144 Israeli settler attacks from what they say are some minor rock-throwing incidents and others that are much more violent that all took place on Saturday.
Also drones from Iran, apparently.
Yes, so this is an exclusive in the Wall Street Journal mentioning that Blinken has also arrived in Israel after Israel admitted to carrying out a clandestine drone strike targeting a defense compound in Iran. This is part of American and Israeli ways looking to contain what the journal describes as Tehran's nuclear and military ambitions.
Mm. Let's move on now to this awful story of the murder of Tyrone Nichols by 5 Memphis police officers. There's now been some appalling video footage released, which actually I can't watch. A lot of the papers pick up on this.
Yes, so widespread coverage in both the US papers, UK papers like The Guardian, and also coverage in Le Monde, showing the extent to which this is an international story. Looking at how, you know, although the murder of Tyrone Nichols occurred in early January, as you say, the video was released over the weekend. And this, you know, what the consequences of being able to see the video mean. So The Guardian, for example, interviewing a number of social scientists and policing experts who were saying that essentially the video underscores what one said, the need for reform in policing across the United States, and the fact that the 5 officers that are involved in the murder were also black shows that this is a story that's about structural issues around policing and not just race relations in the United States.
Mm. Now, AI, and more specifically ChatGPT, it's going to take over BuzzFeed?
Well, it depends. Do you feel that ChatGPT might be coming for our jobs, Georgina?
I think it might do a better job, perhaps, in my case. I don't know.
Well, some outlets do and don't disagree. So BuzzFeed perhaps does, although they're saying that ChatGPT, the AI program, will be writing content for them, but it's only going to be used to create quizzes and, in the words of Jonah Peretti, the head of BuzzFeed, help with brainstorming and assisting in personalizing content, which sounds very human for an AI. Apparently, according to CNN, this boosted BuzzFeed's stock by more than 150% when they announced this. But if you believe Vanity Fair, which has quite a rundown of all the different ways that AI has been used in journalism and notably failed in the case of some financial reporting, the takeaway from Vanity Fair is if you're doing original reporting and unearthing things people don't already know, you're probably going to be okay. But if you're an analysis person, 20 years down the road, you might need to find something else to do because AI might actually be taking our jobs.
Finally, let's go to what they're calling a bizarre 1-in-100-year event in Australia.
Yes, so this is a tiny capsule of radioactive material that has been lost along a 1,400-kilometer stretch of road in Perth that authorities are now hunting for after apparently not realizing it was missing because it was so tiny. So this is a tiny radioactive gauge commonly used in the mining industry that was transported from a mining site on the 11th of January, arrived in a depot in Perth on the 16th of January, and then suddenly on the 25th of January, the authorities realized that this tiny, highly radioactive material, which contains a small amount of cesium-137, which a health officer has said, despite its size, contains quite a large dose of radiation, is lost somewhere along this highway. And so now people are trying to find it while also staying far away from it.
Extraordinary story, Ruth. Thank you very much indeed. That was Ruth Michelson in Istanbul. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It's time for a transport news roundup now with Monocle's transport correspondent, Gabriel Lee. Hello to you, Gabriel.
Hello.
Flybe has collapsed, and this is the second time in 3 years. Tell us more.
Yeah, sadly, we've seen that Flybe has had a hard time in recent years. During the pandemic, they first went into administration, they entered bankruptcy, and were bought out. So for a while, they shut down. They mostly serve domestic regional routes within the UK, but they're an important feeder for different, you know, routes that are underserved. But they had a hard time making it through the pandemic. They were bought out. They started up again just last year, and less than a year later, they have gone under again, it seems, cancelled all flights and made all staff redundant. So it's a tricky one for Flybe.
And do we know why?
I think they had a hard time making these routes work. You know, for one reason is that other competitors actually stepped in to fill some of the busier routes. That and the fact that regional domestic networks within the UK have long been difficult to make money on, I think. So, you know, it's a tricky business model and they couldn't quite make it work. But they do have one thing that's very valuable, which is some slots at London Heathrow. So that's going to be sort of up for sale now as they look for a new buyer, a new owner.
Right. Now, there's news from Lufthansa.
That's right. So Lufthansa are looking into buying a majority stake in ITA, which is basically the successor to Alitalia, still government-run by the Italian government. They basically took Alitalia, removed the branding, started a new airline with the same basic idea, and they're looking for someone to take over, basically. Italy doesn't want to own this airline forever. So Lufthansa looks like an interesting potential for that. They seem to be interested in sort of capitalizing on the fact that although Lufthansa doesn't necessarily want to wade into Italy too much, they do bring many passengers from Italy to the rest of the world via Germany, so it would help them to sort of corner that market a little more.
Mm. Let's have a look at New Zealand. As we've been reporting in our headlines, there's been absolutely terrible weather there and lots of flooding, and that, of course, affecting Auckland Airport.
Right, yeah, it flooded many of the terminal areas and made it impossible to even reach the airport in some cases, and that meant that for a time, into this past weekend, there couldn't be any international arrivals coming into the airport, and they actually just restarted all the processes, customs, immigration, allowing flights in on Sunday. It meant that some flights, which had been sort of halfway into their long-haul flight to Auckland, had to turn right back around and go back to where they came from, which resulted, at least in one case, in a nearly 13-hour flight from Dubai back to Dubai for some unlucky Emirates passengers.
What a nightmare. Finally, let's have a look at this bus service, the first full-size autonomous bus service in the UK.
Right, that's right. So the autonomous bus services are being trialed all over the place. There's very few in actual operation. And this is kind of a special one because it's actually a full-size autonomous bus. So you see a number of these trials have been around sort of mini buses that drive people around on very limited routes. And this is one in the UK, in East Scotland, that seems to be the first one. It will be the first one that will actually carry people in a full-size bus on a proper bus route and without any driver. So that's sort of a revolutionary thing in maybe an unlikely place. We might have expected to see that happen in Oslo or something like that, but this will be the first example.
And what the plan is then to roll it out countrywide?
Well, we'll see about that. I think it's still sort of all of these, they're taking very, very careful baby steps with all of these sort of things. So they want to see that it works on this one route. And then if that's successful, there are a number of other towns and cities across the UK and across the world, of course, that are, you know, looking at these, testing them out, you know, looking to sort of roll out services properly starting from this year. So I think this will be a good test, and if it all works out, if everyone's happy, if riders are okay with getting onto an autonomous bus with no driver, then we'll start to see more and more for sure.
Would you be happy?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I think I wouldn't mind it. I might want to see how it goes for the first few weeks and months. You know, I wouldn't be entirely without trepidation, but I think, you know, they have been taking this very, very carefully and conservatively, because I think they're aware of the potential pitfalls. If one drives off a bridge or something, you know, that'll be the end for quite some time. So, you know, they're being very careful about it. So, yeah, I think it would.
Gabriel, thank you very much indeed. That's Gabriel Lee, who is our transport correspondent. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs program. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
One of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, the space race has been heating up of late, with renewed efforts by the US and China to explore the moon and private ventures involving characters like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson. But the latest entrant is likely to raise eyebrows into orbit. Tiny Montenegro is one of Europe's smallest countries, with a population of fewer than 1 million people. But its prime minister is promising to put the country into space. Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delorne, can tell us more. Hello to you, Guy.
Good morning, Georgina.
Is Montenegro really joining the space race?
Well, Prime Minister Dritan Ambazovic assures us that the matter is serious. And, you know, I have to say, when I first saw this headline, Montenegro's space program launching, announces Dritan Ambazovic, I thought, what on earth are you actually going on about here, mate? Because, you know, you might be aware that Montenegro it isn't the biggest country in the world. It's got a population of about 600,000 people, and one would have thought it has priorities other than going to space. Prime Minister Dritan Ambazovic says, yep, he's serious about this, acknowledges that this information will cause some ridicule, no kidding, and that it will be the subject of memes. Now, he was absolutely right about the last part, because I'm looking now at a little page of memes that I've just, you know, searched for just to see what sort of things people were mocking up. There was a rather nice one of Dritan Ambazovic in a sort of Neil Armstrong kind of pose in a spacesuit in front of the moon. There's another one of him, and I believe it is Milo Djukanovic, the president of Montenegro, in EVA spacesuits with the slogan, and maybe we'll come back to Earth. Who can tell? And to his credit, Dritan Ambazovic has posted all of these on his own Facebook page just to show that he isn't taking it too seriously.
But, I mean, that's not the only reason people are laughing, is it?
No, it's as I alluded to just then, Montenegro's got bigger things to worry about at the moment than going into space, because Mr. Ambazovic might be prime minister, but he actually lost a confidence vote in August, which means that his government has been operating in, as they say, a technical capacity since then. There have been talks going on behind the scenes and in front of the scenes to try and form a new government. There's been an ongoing conflict between parliament and the president, Milo Djukanovic, over who has the right to to choose the head of the next government, been protests in front of the National Assembly, not to mention the fact that the Constitutional Court currently doesn't have a quorum. And without a Constitutional Court, you can't do an awful lot of things involving the appointment of a government and the starting of an election campaign. So the country's got big problems. And of course, people in Montenegro are wondering, why on earth are we talking about a space program when we have these far more earthbound problems to discuss?
Well, let's look at how they're going to do it practically. Are they proposing launching rockets from the Adriatic?
Wouldn't that be great? And I can just imagine if you were, say, in the Bay of Kotor, what a spectacular launch site that would be. I imagine that it is entirely the wrong latitude, though, for that sort of thing. So what they're actually doing is, through a very small outfit, and this is actually quite realistic. When you look into the project, it's actually a really lovely little project. It's called Montenegro Space Research. And they are launching a nano satellite, which is called Lucha. And Lucha actually means light, as in lightweight, but also, hey, a beacon of light in the darkness, I suppose. And they're going to put this into orbit using a balloon. And they're doing a variety of different tests on this. They're using the balloon to go into high orbit. The satellite will gather some data without actually going to, actually, it's not orbit, high altitude, won't go into orbit, will gather data, come back down. But eventually the idea is that it will go up in this balloon, and then the final stage will be rocket propelled and put this nano satellite into orbit. So it's a rather more low-tech, low-cost version of what Richard Branson was trying to do in Britain by, launching rockets from a jumbo jet. Instead of this, they're using a balloon to do it. And, it's a perfectly rational and low-cost way of doing it. And if you're a tiny country like Montenegro, it actually makes some sort of sense.
But do they need it?
I tell you what they need more than anything else. The really interesting thing about this announcement by Dritan Abazovic was he said, if you want to join in with the funding of this project, you can. And a mere €250,000 will get you economic citizenship of Montenegro. Now, when I looked into this further, it seems that the Economic Citizenship Fund of Montenegro has already attracted €300 million. So this is people who are wanting Montenegrin passports in exchange for, punting some money into the national coffers or into some sort of projects or businesses or what have you in Montenegro, which would somehow count as economic citizenship. Now, what sort of characters, Georgina, could possibly be interested in such a thing, especially bearing in mind that Montenegro has visa-free access to the European Union and is deep into European Union accession talks?
Quite. I see that. I mean, he's been a busy man, Mr. Abazovic. He's also discussing having Montenegro's first digital currency.
Oh my word! You're ahead of me on that one. I mean, aren't digital currencies last year's things?
Quite possibly.
After SBF and all that.
Guy, is there any other space activity in the region?
Well, here's the thing. The Montenegro space program say that they want to be part of the European Space Agency. That's their ultimate ambition. And if they look a little further north to Slovenia, where I'm talking to you from now, they can see there is a possibility of doing this. So Slovenia, which has a population not that much bigger than Montenegro, we've got 2 million here, as against 600,000 there. Slovenia's already got its first two satellites in orbit. They went up a couple of years ago. And they have a very well-regarded satellite program at Maribor University. So, the mouse can roar, Georgina, when it comes to going into space.
Absolutely, Guy. Thank you very much indeed. That's Monocle's Balkans correspondent there, Guy Delaunay. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks very much to our producers, Marcus Hippie and Laura Kramer, our researchers, Lillian Fawcett and Andre Nikolai Parmentuin, and our studio manager, Adam Heaton. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be with you all morning with lots of sharp programming and, of course, our global playlist. And the briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.